This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. On the Westminster Hour tonight, two MPs, both with firm views about their party's handling of the election campaign. Stephen Kinnock, newly returned Labour MP for Aberavon, and George Freeman, Conservative MP for Mid Norfolk, a former minister and chairman of his party's policy forum. We'll get views from both of you about your leaders and the election campaign later in the programme. Also here with us, the economist Ruth Lee, who campaigned for Brexit, and Tom Newton-Dunn, political editor of The Sun, is here as well. Now, look, we've got to start by looking at the terrible events at Grenfell Tower, the fire that's taken so many lives, left so many people distraught, homeless, looking for answers. And it continues to have repercussions in the political world as well. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has said that the fire was a preventable accident caused by years of neglect by the local council and successive national governments. The government's drafted in extra staff to improve its response to the fire. The Prime Minister is going to chair another meeting of the Grenfell Tower Recovery Task Force tomorrow morning. And as you probably know, that there will be a minute's silence at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning in remembrance of those who lost their lives or who've been affected by the fire. And our MPs here, and Tom, do you think the government and the authorities are finally getting a grip? What do you think, George Freeman?
Well, firstly, this is my first chance to extend sympathy with all those who've been affected. It's the most horrific and appalling incident. I think it's shocked the whole nation. I think everybody accepts, the Prime Minister accepts, that the government's response was too slow and was reflected, actually, the most extraordinary response from the community locally and from the emergency services. And it made Kensington Council and indeed central government look slow to respond. I think the Prime Minister has moved correctly this week to launch a fast public inquiry, the £5 million fund, £5,000 for every family tomorrow morning, a rehousing of all the families and a task force. But this raises some very big questions which should be asked about social housing, about a culture that seemingly decided that £5,000 was too much to pay for flame-proof cladding. I find it unbelievable. So there's some deep questions, and it goes right to the heart of some of the big issues that we are confronting in London and in this country. And they should be asked, and they should be properly answered.
Stephen, Sir Keir Starmer, a former director of public prosecutions, was talking this morning about the inevitability of there being criminal prosecutions. But in the meantime, it's those practical issues of where do the people go? And your leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has suggested that local buildings should be requisitioned and taken over to house these people. Do you agree with him?
Well, I'd just first of all like to echo George's comments. This is my first chance as well to extend my sympathy to the families and the community of this absolutely appalling and tragic incident. In terms of the response and the dealing with the fallout for these families and the community, obviously everything has to be done, and it should have been done far more quickly. I think the Prime Minister's handling of this has been very poor indeed, and that's putting it diplomatically.
She herself has said that the response was too slow.
Yes, that's right. And so, I mean, that's a start, at least. There's now a recognition, rather than this sort of robotic refusal to recognise where things are not working. Actually, it begins with recognising that things haven't been handled as they should have been. Let's now make sure that we deliver. Actions speak far louder than words. But I think on Jeremy's comments, my view is that if there are properties in the vicinity that are lying empty, not being used at all for any purpose other than just a money laundering vehicle for example, for oligarchs of various descriptions, then I think that, you know, whatever needs to be done to look into the possibility of using them. I think it's very important to clarify, certainly my understanding is that this is not about dealing with properties where people are actually living and are there, but where there is empty, unused property and you've got an absolute crisis on your hands with people still sleeping in the local sports centre, still just not able to get the access to the basic facilities that they need, then I think in a crisis you've got to take crisis action.
Tom Newton-Dunn, what do you understand Jeremy Corbyn to be talking about when he talks about the use of buildings nearby?
Well, it's not altogether clear. He did have another go at sort of pushing this policy this morning. And his precise words were, occupy, compulsory purchase it, requisition it. There's a lot of things you can do. So we didn't just have the requisition. We now had compulsory purchase, but also we had this word occupy. Now, that means to some people, there is a movement out there called occupy, which means going into people's properties, whether they're there or not, illegally to take up occupants. So you're not even using the arm and the force of the government to compulsory purchase. If Jeremy Corbyn didn't want people to think or indeed encourage people to go around and do that, he certainly used some very sloppy language. I'm surprised Stephen hasn't distanced himself from that already.
Well,
no, I mean, I think clearly everything that's done has to be done within the law. I'm working on that assumption. I don't know if others feel that Jeremy was trying to suggest that extra legal action was taken. That was certainly not the way I interpreted his comments. But I also think we're in danger of being distracted here from the much more fundamental question that has to be asked, which is, what is the impact of deregulation, privatisation and relentless austerity on local authorities, on public services, and what is the role of the state going forward to ensure that every person in our country lives in safe and secure housing? And I'm really not trying to make a party political point here. I'm genuinely saying there needs to be a cross-party conversation about this, because we are in danger of being distracted about Theresa May's failings and what Jeremy said about dealing with the crisis. But that's about dealing with the symptoms. We need to address the root causes, and that is years and years of misguided policy about what actually we do to ensure that people live in safe and secure housing. Well, also, don't forget that the report on La Canal came in 2013 and we're still waiting 4 years later
for this Conservative government. That was a fire in 2009, you're referring to.
The fire was in 2009. The coroner's report was in 2013.
Okay. Ruth Lee.
And it was a fire where, in fact, we were not able to contain the fire within a particular flat. I mean, the whole idea of asking people to stay put is that actually the fire will be contained in a flat, but it's quite obvious that that is not happening. Mm. And by the way, I think this business of requisitioning or occupying or even compulsory purchase of private property is a very dangerous slope to go down. I really do.
People have got to live
somewhere,
though, haven't
they? Major doubts about that.
They've got to find somewhere nearby.
The messages that would put out to investors into this country is absolutely devastating. I'd say one other thing, that yes, there's going to be a policy inquiry, as George has mentioned. I think that's right and proper. And in a way, we won't know exactly what has happened and why this has happened until we find that out. But one thing is very, very, very clear. That is, the health and safety regulations, the fire regulations, the building regulations are not adequate. And I am not saying that actually that Kensington Chelsea TMO actually broke the rules. I'm not saying they behaved illegally. I don't know.
Well, it's all to be investigated and they will answer those questions, won't they?
Let's, for the sake of argument, say that they did stick to the rules. Those rules are not adequate anymore. I mean, the mere fact that this thing took off, 24 stories just burst into flame, is shocking beyond belief.
And George Freeman, there were questions raised by the residents. We know that. Blogs, concerns and various ministers' names, housing ministers' names, have been raised in connection with concerns, flags waved very early on. One of those ministers that is facing questions about how much they did and how much they acted on recommendations is Gavin Barwell. He lost his seat in the election and now he's the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. Do you think he can remain in that post while those questions are being asked about his involvement?
I do, as long as he, as I have tonight, makes very clear that all questions must be asked and answered properly. And I would just on housing make the point that everyone now affected, including in the adjacent street, bar I think two people, are all in temporary accommodation, and the government's pledged they will all have a proper home within 3 weeks. In some ways, I really do think while we are still literally exhuming bodies from this, it isn't the time to over-politicise it. And Stephen's been very polite tonight, but I think Jeremy Corbyn is getting very close to the line. in turning this appalling human tragedy into a political cause célèbre. And I think it's very close to the line and quite dangerous. And on housing, he did, as Tom said, got very close to signalling that people could take the law into their own hands and occupy private properties. And that would be a really serious mistake.
And obviously, these questions will intensify over coming weeks. But you're absolutely right. Let us focus on those who are grieving, who've lost family members and loved ones tonight, and take part in that minute's silence tomorrow. Tomorrow as well, we move to Brussels. The focus, it's the talks to agree the terms of the UK's departure. They finally get underway, don't they, Tom? And it's funny, it's the beginning of a week. Friday is exactly a year since the referendum in which the UK voted to leave the EU. So it all gets going tomorrow. What's going to happen?
It really does. And we really can't underestimate the true historic context of this. I mean, this is an enormous thing that begins tomorrow. Without a doubt, the most important thing for the country, for the government to get right, far more important, quite frankly, than who wins the last general election or who wins the next one. Yet it has crept up upon us, as indeed has the year anniversary of the referendum, almost unnoticed, largely because of the incredible fallout from the mess of the general election and, of course, the terrible tragedy with the Grenfell Tower. But we do, it all does begin at 11 a.m. in Brussels tomorrow. Now, some quite interesting developments, actually, over the last two or three days. Again, almost entirely unreported, largely because there's no space left in our newspapers and on your airwaves after all the turbulence in Grenfell we've been reporting. But that is that the government have moved considerably towards the EU's position on a number of things. On the big business of sorting out the divorce element of the negotiation before they get on to trade. Government's conceded on that. Without agreeing to sign on the dotted line at the end of the divorce talks, they've said, yeah, let's get EU citizens, the bill and Northern Ireland sorted out first, which was something Theresa May was adamant about refusing two or three months ago. And also the process. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, wanted it all done in four-week cycles. So 1 week of talks and another of going back to your capitals and another of preparation, etc. And we learned over the weekend David Davis has folded on that as well. So interesting, the government is already, and you can see why, because the government really has no majority in the House of Commons, so to speak, of yet, no DUP deal, no real mandate from the electorate to do what they probably wanted to do. So already UK PLC looks a little bit weakened going to this and is behaving a little bit weakened as well.
And it's one day of talks tomorrow and a press conference, and then Theresa May goes to a summit later in the week.
Exactly. Very interestingly, both Michel Barnier and David Davis, the two main players facing off against each other in Brussels tomorrow, have agreed to do a joint press conference at 6:30 Brussels time tomorrow night. Now, as you know as well as I do, politicians don't agree to stand side by side each other on platforms as important as that unless they can both stand up and say something incredibly nice and warm and touchy and feely. So I predict there'll be something. They'll have already announced they can.
They'll each have something.
They've got an amazing great breakthrough after me a few hours of talking. But the optics of this are really important, actually, on both sides, to get this off well. Quite frankly, if they all end up walking out by tomorrow night, you know, the markets across European capitals, not just London, would plummet and would be very, very scared indeed. So the optics as well as the substance, I think, will be part of the game tomorrow.
All right, lovely. Well, we will hear what our panellists think about this in a moment, but Ireland has a new Taoiseach or Prime Minister in place, Leo Varadkar, and he'll no doubt have pressing views about how that border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland will look after Brexit. As you said, Tom, that's going to be one of the three key issues coming up alongside the status of citizens and the size of the divorce bill. The question is, if the UK leaves the customs union without a special agreement in place, is there a way of avoiding tariffs across that border and the return of checks and border posts? All of those involved in the Brexit negotiations say they certainly hope so, and that issue is going to be a priority. I've been talking to the outgoing Irish ambassador to the UK, Daniel Mulhall. He explained how mutually important trade between the UK and the Republic is.
The UK is our number one economic partner. We have more than £50 billion of trade back and forth across the Irish Sea every year. That's £1 billion plus per week. That trade sustains 200,000 jobs in Ireland and 200,000 jobs in the UK. So that trade is valuable not just for Ireland. In proportional terms, obviously, it's more valuable for Ireland, more important for Ireland. But to the UK, Ireland is a major trading partner, a major market. And, for example, Ireland is a more important market for British exporters than China or India. So that's the kind of scale of the interests that apply. And these interests are two-way.
Everyone's saying they want frictionless trade and a tariff-free trade, frictionless border. But surely that is impossible if the UK leaves the single market and, indeed, the customs union.
Well, the European Union's negotiating position, which we were very happy with because it reflects Ireland's interests very clearly, says that we need creative and flexible solutions to be applied on the island of Ireland. So they recognise that the island of Ireland is sui generis. Let's be honest, we would much prefer if the UK decided to remain in the European Union, to remain in the single market, to remain in the customs union. These things would make life much easier for us. And it is true that Brexit gives rise to quite a few uncertainties. We, of course, will be negotiating as part of the 27, but we will be looking to our partners to recognise, as they have shown their determination and their willingness to do in the past year, recognise the special circumstances that apply in Northern Ireland and to act accordingly in order to minimise the impact of Brexit on the border in Ireland, on the peace process and on the common travel area.
Do you welcome the fact that the language around Brexit after the election does seem to be modifying, softening a little? Indeed, you've got Boris Johnson talking about an open Brexit and the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, advocating a jobs and economy first Brexit. Do you think that that could indicate the UK government moving towards a compromise or some sort of transitional position?
Well, our government has made it quite clear that we want to see an orderly Brexit. We want to see one that has a transition period in order to smooth the difficulties involved and to enable new arrangements to be put in place. I've been through enough negotiations now in the European Union to know that the European Union has a great gift for reaching compromise solutions, reaching agreement, even in circumstances where agreement might look difficult or even impossible at the outset.
Do you think that there will be an attitude and a willingness to maybe do some sort of bespoke deal for the UK in the end to allow the frictionless border between the North and South in Ireland?
If you want to predict the future, the best thing to do is to look at the past. And the past would suggest that the European Union has a great capacity to come up with solutions, even in difficult situations. And I hope that both sides will enter these negotiations. Certainly, we would like to see both sides enter the negotiations in a spirit of compromise, in a spirit of positivity, looking for the right kind of outcome which will benefit all of our countries and all of our peoples.
And, of course, the election result here has substantially changed Theresa May's room for manoeuvre. She will have to get some sort of deal that can get past the parliamentary arithmetic in the Commons, which again is seen by some people as moving towards a sort of softer Brexit, maybe not a hardline Brexit.
I hope that we will see a pragmatic approach to these negotiations on the part of both of the negotiating parties. But these are going to be complicated negotiations, mm-hmm. and they won't be quick, and there will be times when it'll look as if things are not going so well and people will wonder why they're not making more progress. That's just the way negotiations go.
Do you think it's possible to strike a deal in 2 years, or are we inevitably going to move into some sort of transition process?
Well, I think our government have said a number of times that we believe that a transition arrangement will be required. Again, that's a matter really for the UK, and it's a matter for the negotiations to produce agreement on issues like that. And I wouldn't like to second guess these negotiations.
And of course, you have a new Taoiseach in place now.
Yes, and a new Minister for Foreign Affairs and Trade. So we have a new team now involved in the Brexit negotiations. Our new Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, new Taoiseach, said last week that he would be leading a government of the new European centre. So you can see in that he has a quite strong European focus. But he will also, I know, will want to develop the closest possible relationship with his British counterpart, as our Taoiseach have done going back over many, many years.
Amid all of this, Theresa May is also having to prop up her government by attempting to strike a deal with the 10 Democratic Unionist MPs at Westminster. The talks are ongoing. What did you make of the intervention of the former Prime Minister, Sir John Major, who said that he's very wary, very dubious about the deal? He said it risks compromising the UK government's impartiality and could give, as he called them, the hard men, an excuse to return to violence.
Our government has pointed out many times the requirement in the Good Friday Agreement, which after all is an international agreement between the British and Irish governments, which requires rigorous impartiality. And also we see that, or we have noted the fact that the DUP have commented that they would like to use their influence in the best interests of Northern Ireland, including avoiding a hard border. So this issue is a matter for the British government, but the requirement of rigorous impartiality is there and I think is well recognised by all sides. The Good Friday Agreement has been a huge plus for everyone on these islands, and that's the only show in town, and we need to make sure that that gets implemented. I know our Foreign Minister, our new Foreign Minister, will be in Belfast in the coming weeks seeking to encourage the parties towards an agreement between them which will enable the executive to be re-established to the benefit of all.
That's Daniel Mulhall, the Irish ambassador. Ruth Lee, he talked there of pragmatism. Everyone wants to solve this issue of the border, but how can we solve this question while leaving the customs union and the single market? I mean, won't there have to be border checks of some kind when you've got Northern Ireland up against the Republic, which is in the EU?
Well, suggestions I've heard, and who knows how this is going to be resolved, is that you might actually have British customs based in Irish ports, so that as items went into the Irish ports, then they could actually decide on the customs then. And similarly, for passport control, it may be that you have passport control for the island of Great Britain, but you keep Ireland as a unit. So those are possibilities, and I don't know how they're going to work out. But I think, obviously, as Thomas said, this is one of the big three that have to be discussed in the divorce proceedings, and progress has to be made on these things before actually the negotiations can move on to stage two, which, as Thomas correctly identified, that we've all agreed to, and you can start talking about the new relationship between the UK and the EU. I mean, the other thing you would need is that there is a continuation of some sort of free trade and tariff-free trade. In other words, out of the customs union, but agreeing a free trade agreement, which is what we would want in any case, in my view.
Well, he was saying that there's inevitably going to have to be some sort of transition period at the end of the 2 years. We can't get it all done in 2 years.
I'd be staggered if there weren't. And I think one has to be pragmatic about this. Forget about hard or soft or this, that and the other Brexit. We've got to be pragmatic about this. And just thinking about this, let's just say there's good progress on stage one. Then the negotiations may start on the new relationship the end of this year, the beginning of next year. Mm. There's only another year to go before we actually leave. And under those circumstances, we have an implementation period, as the white paper said, or we have a transition period, as already conceded as a possibility by the EU. I think that's the way to go.
Stephen, you've been writing about your thoughts on this, about a transition deal, but basically you think that on the 1st of April 2019, the UK should join the European Economic Area as Norway, Liechtenstein and Iceland have done. Mm. Why do you think that would be beneficial to the UK?
Because I think, given the incredibly compressed time frame that we're working towards, the idea of getting a bespoke, tailored transition deal done, in addition to all of the other very challenging items on the agenda, and given the completely discredited Prime Minister that we're dealing with, who's being held to ransom by the DUP and has a totally split parliamentary party on this, with a lot of the Brextremists breathing down her neck.
That's a new word.
Given that context, we're not going to be able to get a tailored, bespoke transition deal. And the obvious solution then is the EEA. It's a ready-made package. Everybody understands it. It would give a huge amount of certainty to business that something new... We're not reinventing the wheel.
Well, you say it will provide unfettered access to the single market while providing scope for curbs on freedom of movement. But isn't it the case that Norway has to accept freedom of movement? So, well, and also a lot of EU regulations, which it doesn't have a say informing.
But in fact, Liechtenstein, and I know it sounds bizarre to compare the UK to Liechtenstein because it's a microstate,
little, tiny,
but there is a legal
place.
Precedent, which is under Article 112 of the EEA, they are allowed to set quotas on freedom of movement and they're allowed to have an emergency break. So within the EEA, it is actually possible to have an emergency break. But what I would also say is the point with the transition deal is it buys you the time to negotiate the really big ticket items, which are the future trading relationship and issues such as free movement. And if we try and do that by March 2019, we'll be doing it with a gun held to our heads. The problem that Theresa, this is eminently sensible in my view, the problem is I don't know if Theresa May, given how weak she is at the moment, can sell this to the Brextremists on her backbenches.
If she doesn't come up with this as a possibility, or David Davis, would you be prepared to sort of table this? When would be the moment to put this before your parliamentary colleagues and see if you've got agreement?
Well, in the piece that you mentioned, Caroline, I talked about building a coalition of common sense. And that actually means, I think, Labour and other parties reaching out to the sensible wing of the Conservative Parliamentary Party. And when you look at the parliamentary arithmetic then, I think you've got a clear majority for a sensible transition deal, which in my view is the slope out of the EU rather than the cliff edge. And that's what we all have to
Sorry,
be building towards.
Let me just ask George about that, because the question is, would some of your parliamentary colleagues back Stephen in pushing for an idea like this? As he mentioned, the parliamentary arithmetic means he would need you or some other Conservative backbenchers to back him in that.
Well, look, I welcome the fact that the mood is changing. I've felt since the referendum last year that the Conservative Party has been allowed to start to sound like a very shrill, ideological, partisan, single-issue party that thinks Brexit is somehow going to solve all the many problems we face. And I welcome the fact that that view is now clearly not sustained in the country or even in the Conservative Party in Parliament. We're committed, yes, to renegotiating our relationship with Europe. But I, for one, joined the Conservative Party in no small part because it's the party of business, the party of enterprise, the party that believes that you create opportunity and wealth by supporting enterprise and business. And I welcome the comments of the Foreign Secretary today and the Chancellor around having a more open Brexit, focus more around business. And I have some
rather than immigration, because, of course, that has been the issue up until now.
Well, look, in the end, I don't like the hard, soft language. I think we have to be quite hard-nosed and quite soft-tongued. And the truth is, this is about money, markets and movement. And I think Stephen is right in that it's very unlikely that we're going to get the full comprehensive deal that this country and Europe mutually deserve. And I think a period in the EEA while we get to that deal may well work, but we've got to get an ambitious deal. It's in Europe's interest as well as ours.
You say that you fear your party sounding shrill on this.
Was.
Well, how seriously do you take the threats of an early challenge to Theresa May unless she continues to pursue hard Brexit? I mean, some of the headlines today are saying that she's been told she's got 10 days to save her position and make sure that she sticks absolutely to the hard Brexit plan.
Well, all I can tell you is I've been pretty outspoken this week and no one has approached me with any talk of leadership at all. Everybody I talk to is absolutely clear that
but
Theresa
she's under
May,
pressure, isn't she, to stick to the original plan,
well, of course,
not this new plan.
This is incredibly complex. We're not just negotiating with the EU, by the way. We're negotiating with the 48% who wonder whether they're being listened to. And we're negotiating with Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and overseas countries. This is incredibly tough. And, you know, you don't need me to tell you that the Prime Minister is in a very difficult situation. But I do not hear colleagues wanting a leadership election at all. I don't hear anyone wanting a
That's
general
because
election.
Because you don't want Stephen and his party to win
follow. No, it's not that. It's that I hear a Conservative Party that recognises we didn't get a mandate for that hard Brexit, and there is a mandate for Brexit, yes, but for one that works for business, and that does require transition. And I think we're going to have a more open Brexit, and I welcome it. And I think if we put the country and business and wealth creation first, we'll win out. If it's an austerity Brexit, we'll lose the whole lot.
Ah, well, that's another issue altogether now.
I was just
Ruth.
Going to say about this transition period, I don't think it's just a matter of the single market or staying in the single market during that period, but also in the customs union, because to me, actually, the bigger worry is about the tariffs rather than actually what happens with the single market. But let's be clear about this. This is a transition period. This is temporary. And at the end of the day, I have little doubt. David Davis, as he goes into negotiations, will honour what Theresa May was saying at the beginning of the year. At the end of the day, we will be out of the customs union, out of the single market, with a good trade relationship.
Right.
But it will take time.
But Keir Starmer says we could be in the customs union. So
well,
that's your Brexit lead, Steve.
The question has to go to the DUP. I mean, the DUP, for them, it's a red line that there is the softest possible border in Northern Ireland. How can you possibly have that if you come out of the customs union?
Well,
I think Theresa May has entered into this deal with the DUP and it's in direct conflict with the idea of staying inside the customs union.
All right. Tom, just briefly, I mean, this is all happening with the Queen's speech bubbling away. The Prime Minister must have imagined a very different legislative programme, my goodness, as she embarked on the general election. And now she's got this reduced majority, as Stephen mentioned, the talks going on with the Democratic Unionists and widespread criticisms of the ideas outlined in her manifesto. So what room for manoeuvre has she got this week? What kind of Queen's speech do you expect to open Parliament?
Well, it's going to be one like we've had never heard before, quite frankly. We've never had a Queen's speech that's going to last 2 whole years before, certainly not in recent times. At the beginning of the coalition government, we had one that lasted 18 months, which was certainly felt like that was going on and on. But a Queen's speech that's going to go through 2 whole years' worth of parliamentary sitting without a majority in the House of Commons. Perhaps the PM will be able to staple on the DUP for some of the measures. Is going to be quite extraordinary, and I think we have to expect almost all of it to be taken up by Brexit legislation, simply because there's simply so much law that needs to be passed and changed for us to be able to even exit the EU and wake up with things, you know, carry on as normal the next morning. But if there is no firm DUP deal, and certainly if the Prime Minister is unable to persuade people like George Freeman to even vote with her, and I think there are some serious doubts after what George said tonight, if it is that sort of version of Brexit, then what, as one minister put it to me last week, we are going to face our Passchendaele in the House of Commons. It will be intestine, bloody warfare, day after day, line after line. And I have to say that is precisely the sort of thing that does end up bringing governments down.
And things like fox hunting, grammar schools, free school lunches, triple lock, winter fuel, not as Theresa May had planned.
I think all of those, plus you can add a whole load more from the Tory manifesto. For example, Theresa May fabled energy cap on energy bills. I think it's hard now to see a parliamentary majority for that.
And those social care plans, of course,
the social
completely
care plans,
out the window.
The great market interventions. The things I think we will still see, though, is, for example, a planning bill, a housing bill, not least after the terrible tragedy of last week. Mm-hmm. It's now imperative for the Tories to show they can try and turn around the appalling state of housing in the country, and obviously a terrorism bill as well. Let's not forget we're still in what is certainly a terrorism crisis, and that also has to be handled at the same time as Brexit, Queen's Speech, DP and Grenfell Tower.
Tom, thank you. George Freeman, you were really critical of the manifesto.
The campaign.
Well, all right, the campaign, shambolic, undemocratic concentration of power in the hands of a narrow inner circle, you said. And as chairman, as you were then, of the Prime Minister's backbench policy board, you would have expected to see a draft of the manifesto and you didn't. So you were unhappy with what was presented to the public and the way that it was presented.
No, just the way it was presented. Actually, let me be very clear.
What about the social care element of the manifesto? Were you happy with that?
Well, look, I think there is an argument to say that we shouldn't be expecting the young, the millennials, the under 25s, to pay for the care costs of a generation who need care today. Particularly when those people, if those people own very substantial properties. But I didn't think the way to handle it was the way it was handled in that manifesto. I think there should have been a proper consultation. You've got a Dilmot proposal. There are two or three others, and I think we could have had a mandate to tackle it without surprising everybody, including myself and half the cabinet, with a specific proposal. Look, I'm glad you mentioned security, because I think Tom made the point well. As if we didn't have enough to cope with as a nation, we have just gone through a general election with some really serious terrorist incidents. And I sense the mood in the country has changed. You know, liberty and security are finally in balance in a liberal democracy. And I sense that if the police are saying to us, we need to look at encryption on things like WhatsApp, on some of those technologies in order to really prevent these, I think the public mood is changing. And Parliament should be debating that, and I hope there will be something in the Queen's speech on that.
Philip Hammond today was suggesting that the government will ease austerity, admitting that the public's weary of the long slog it's endured since the financial crash. Do you think, Ruth, then, that this will be a different type of manifesto to that envisaged before, the fact that Philip Hammond has come out and said that?
I wouldn't expect anything particularly in the Queen's speech, and I agree with Tom. I think you're basically going to major on Brexit. I think the Institute of Government came out recently saying they might, in addition to the Great Repeal Bill, which is a big bill, you might have up to 15 other bills that are connected with Brexit, with agriculture, fishery, etc., etc., etc. They're going to be busy on that. But, of course, the $100 question about austerity will be responded to, really, in the next budget. Because I don't think the Chancellor will be doing anything in the meantime. He's not going to tear up his public spending plans. He's not going to be having extra taxations. And, of course, that new next budget will be in autumn because it's the first of the autumn statement.
Well, Philip Hammond was saying today that he should have been used much more during the election campaign, as he said, to tear apart Jeremy Corbyn's manifesto promises. But, I mean, would that have made a difference?
Well, also to tell the story of the incredible success, actually. I'm proud of it, the coalition. We inherited a car crash in 2010. I do think austerity 1.0 has run its course, and I've been calling loudly for a different model. But we do need to be responsible with the public finances.
Two very quick things. I think the first start, obviously Corbyn was talking about a lot of extra spending, a lot of extra debt that people will have to pay for. The second thing is, I think, come the autumn budget, I suspect Philip Hammond will be very, very careful about how much he does relax the fiscal policy. We're still running deficits. We've got to live within our means.
Stephen, there was quite a lot of largesse in the Labour manifesto, to put it mildly. You know, the nationalisations didn't have figures next to them, although the rest of the manifesto was pretty much costed. And then, of course, there was that last-minute suggestion that student debt could be written off. Were you completely happy with that manifesto? And did you feel that you could argue in favour of it?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think the reason that the Tories didn't talk much about the economy is, in fact, they've lost it on the economy because we're in a situation where wages have stagnated for the longest period since the Napoleonic Wars.
All right, but look, you put
forward
your manifesto.
I will take no lectures from the Tories on economic competence. They said that they would balance the books by 2015. They're now saying 2025. Right. So their competence is shot
to
pieces.
You put forward your alternative agenda.
We put forward our manifesto, as you say, $48.6 billion in tax raising measures, including $3.9 billion of contingency measures, and $48.6 billion in terms of spending on things like taking the cap off public sector pay, which has been leading to massive amounts of in-work poverty. On renationalisation, it's the purchase of an asset. And that asset, once it the profits that it's generating, are coming to exchequer.
Okay.
And also on the transformation fund, I don't know if colleagues have noticed, but we have interest rates at record low levels. That's the time.
So you were happy with that?
Well, it's either carry on as normal and normal isn't working, or change something.
Look, just a quick question to you.
We took the mantle of change in this election, and that's why we did so much better than people expected.
A quick question to you, Stephen, because we've got to move on. But you were very critical of Jeremy Corbyn. Even during the campaign after the local elections, you said that he was being raised negatively on the doorstep. Your personal vote share went up. Have you changed your view about him now? Lots of people are asking about whether you and others who criticised him are now sort of saying, oh, well, we'll pull in behind him.
It's no secret that I've had my differences with Jeremy, but something amazing happened during this campaign. First of all, the Tories ran the most dismal and appalling campaign in living memory. And secondly,
George Freeman's nodding at that.
We worked as a team. Jeremy did his job. He did well on the TV. He did great rallies around the country, engaging with the public. And we worked our socks off on the ground, used our ground game. The Conservative ground game was also absolutely hopeless. And so it was something magical happened during that campaign where Labour brought itself back together again. And I'm very proud of the result that we achieved.
Okay.
But we are still 60 seats behind the Tories. Very important to note that we did not win this election, and people need to ensure that we don't get carried away with that.
The election brought 87 new faces into the Commons from the various parties. Only 2 days last week it was put aside for them to all get sworn in. They're now getting to grips with life at Westminster. Some of the new intake were fully expecting to to be elected, but for others it did come as a bit of a shock, even if a pleasant one. But in a hung parliament, as we've been discussing, every single one of those MPs will be crucial in the many tight votes that we can expect over the coming weeks and months. Keith McDougall's been meeting some of the new honourable members.
This station is Westminster. Exit here for Westminster Abbey and Houses of Parliament.
From all directions, the MPs are flocking back to Westminster. There's much to catch up on, and over the cappuccinos. In the atrium, beneath the MPs' offices in Portcullis House, the stories from the campaign are being exchanged. The old faces mingle with the new ones. There's a sad word or two for former colleagues who've lost their seats. Meanwhile, the new MPs are equipping themselves for their new job.
Maybe an hour ago, I was wrestling with a computer. I was trying to save something to the desktop. About 10 minutes later, a gentleman shows up saying, "Hello, I'm from the digital team. Do you need any help?" And I just thought, my goodness, it's as if you were in my head.
Leila Moran will represent Oxford West and Abingdon, one of the 87-strong new intake, whose lives will never be quite the same again, having acquired the status of Member of Parliament.
I mean, it's bewildering. It's like no place I've ever been before, you know. But I can say that it's steeped in history, that it's a place to be respected.
Laura Pidcock, the new Labour MP for North West Durham, relishing the challenge ahead and filling me in on where she's come from.
I started off my career in McDonald's at the age of 15, but then went off to university, did a degree in politics, but was a mental health support worker as well.
So how do I do a hand
just
on
just as you wish, and just read it.
OK. So, I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors, according to law. So help me God.
Thank you.
Inside the Commons, the swearing-in of all MPs, old and new, is taking place. And in a short speech, the re-elected Speaker refers to the higher-than-ever level of diversity of members.
I was adopted, came to the UK, I left school with no qualifications, was a labourer in a cotton mill, bus driver, then youth worker, police officer in Greater Manchester Police, and then a local councillor, Lord Mayor.
Labour's Afzal Khan is the successor to the late Sir Gerald Kaufman. He says a more ethnically diverse chamber is good for Parliament, good for the country.
I mean, it's pretty important, isn't it, that we have reflection of the society that we are. And this Parliament has been more diverse than any other previously, so we seem to be going in the right direction.
But when considering matters of diversity, be careful, warns the new Conservative, Kemi Badenoch.
It's also very dangerous to pigeonhole people based on what they look like. With me, for instance, people hear that, you know, you're a black MP and they automatically assume they know what your background is, they know what level of education you have, what things you'll be interested in and talking about. And, you know, I don't just want to talk about gangs and knife crime and so on. I want to talk about science and engineering and, you know, political philosophy. And I'm hoping that we can do more than just be the black faces or the female faces.
The election of Lib Dem Leila Moran marks a significant ethnic landmark too.
So apparently I am the first MP of Palestinian descent. My mother is Palestinian and it wasn't why I was elected. I hope that my background brings a bit of flavour, a bit of interest in, and maybe a slightly different angle of knowledge to some issues. Ultimately, I'm not going to use it as any kind of leverage. I didn't ask to be born with that heritage, I just was. So where it's useful, I'll use it, and where it's not, I won't.
I'm Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative MP for Moray.
There are more pandas in Edinburgh Zoo than Tory MPs in Scotland. That was the SNP's standing joke, but it won't work any longer. On June the 8th, Douglas Ross got the considerable scalp of the SNP's Angus Robertson, a win, he believes, that underlines the resurgence of Scottish conservatism.
We'll be meeting as a group of Scottish Conservative MPs. We've already done that with David Mundell as the Secretary of State for Scotland, and we'll be looking to work together on Scottish issues.
Do you think there could be points of contention between English Conservatives and Scottish Conservatives?
Well, all I've seen so far is the English Conservatives very happy that they've got so many Scottish Conservatives coming down here.
The SNP lost a third of their MPs, including the charismatic Alex Salmond. The Nationalists have one new MP, though.
Going in on Monday morning and hanging my coat up in the members-only cloakroom to find a pink ribbon where I could hang my sword was a bit of a surreal experience.
27-year-old David Lyndon sounding more than a little like the next generation.
I think there are a number of people who are heroes. Alex Salmond is definitely a hero. I mean, there's something quite surreal about the fact that, you know, Alex Salmond was a parliamentarian longer than I've been alive. And it was really sad, you know, that the night that I got elected, he didn't come back.
Labour, 258. There's no way the Conservatives can go to 326. So, it is a hung parliament. The Conservatives have 309 seats.
We're getting used to hung parliaments. The 2010 election resulted in the coalition between the Conservatives and the Lib Dems. The Lib Dem Alistair Carmichael was the coalition's deputy chief whip.
I would not want to be a government whip in this parliament because they will be at the mercy of their backbenchers and the Democratic Unionist Party. Now, the DUP, in offering a confidence and supply arrangement, gets Theresa May to the starting line, basically. So she knows she'll get a Queen's Speech, she knows she'll get a budget. But if you're going to make your government work, you need more than that. You need to win every vote every day.
So how do the new MPs view the prospect of those daily, or rather nightly, trudges through the voting lobbies, often after long, drawn-out debates in the chamber? The new Labour MP, Laura Pidcock.
But that's what I'm here for, you know. Millions of people out there work many, many long hours, you know, late-night shift work, and why should we be any different?
And it seems a strict regime is already in place in the Conservatives' whip's office. New MP Kemi Badenoch suffered one disappointment in her first few days.
There will be lots of knife-edge votes. Minority government is not easy. I've had to cancel a holiday. Already the whips have told me, they've apologised and said, sorry, but we're not really sure that's going to happen anymore.
An early showdown with the whips, having to cancel your first holiday.
No, it wasn't a showdown. I told them that this is happening. What are the odds of me being able to go? And they smiled and they said, unlikely, that they'll do what they can.
And what about the priorities of the new members? An answer Labour's Laura Pidcock gives me suggests that practical realities are coming before ambition, just at the moment.
Do you want to be Prime Minister?
No, I want to find somewhere to live in London. That's my immediate priority.
Keith McDougall talking to some of the people. I'm sure we'll be hearing their voices on this programme in the near future. Now, Tom is back with the papers, and my goodness, the Daily Mail, what a picture on the front of the Daily Mail there.
The Daily Mail is carrying an extraordinary picture from inside Grenfell Tower. The Metropolitan Police released a series of images taken from inside the tower over the last couple of days. All the other papers will carry them, but this is inside of a flat, and everything inside of it is reduced just to the hardest core
charred.
Of metal. There is nothing else at all. There's some brickwork and just metal. You can see the outside of a washing machine, what looks to be an old ironing board and a cooker, but there is nothing else. And it just shows that how nothing could have survived in there. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, most of the other front pages are centred around Brexit. The great big day, historic, whether you like it or not, is indeed happening tomorrow. Some startlingly different takes, it has to be said, across the different papers. For The Express, it's a big banner headline, EU exit deal to boost Britain. Confidence high as talks begin today. The Guardian takes a rather different point of view, which is they've been talking to some European diplomats who now tell The Guardian they're extremely worried that Theresa May won't be able to broker any form of proper negotiation because she's so weakened at home, she's unable to deviate at all from the very strict and slightly meaningless party line at the moment. Because she does, she'll be immediately defenestrated. And that then leads us on to a couple of the papers speculating again about Mrs. May's leadership. So the FT, their main splash headline, are very pleased that Philip Hammond talked about a slope rather than a cliff edge for the transitional deal implementation phase, as Mrs. May would prefer us to refer it to. But they've also got an interview with George Osborne in tomorrow's paper, Mrs. May's nemesis, yet again sticking the knife in, calling Mrs. May very weak at a time when the country needs leadership and suggesting unless she starts showing some leadership, she needs to shuffle off. Times also getting stuck in on Philip Hammond putting the knife into Mrs. May. But the best of all is the Daily Telegraph, which has a front page headline, David Davis, he, the Brexit secretary, tipped to be interim Tory leader, suggesting that this is now allies of Boris Johnson think David Davis should now run to stand in for a little one. They've got the greatest little bit of gossip of all buried inside the text here, which is Boris Johnson and Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, big supporter of Theresa May, were spotted in the back garden of a Kent pub on Saturday night having a very, very long pint and wrapped in a very, very deep conversation. What on earth could they have been discussing?
George Freeman, I've got 20 seconds from you at the end. As someone who said on this programme a moment ago that the European Economic Area could be a way of the UK having a transitional arrangement, do you think that David Davis could do that for us if he was leader? Will he be leader?
First thing I think is having a beer in a Kentish pub sounds an excellent way to spend an afternoon. I don't know what an interim leader is, actually. And I think the truth is we are living in the most extraordinary volatile period of British politics. It's not easy for anyone to lead. And if we focus on getting a Brexit that works for the economy, I think the public will move in behind us.
George Freeman, Ruth Lee, Tom Newton-Dunn and Stephen Kinnock, thanks very much. Join us again same time next week.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.